There it goes. Tonight's Monday, July 13th, 2026, at 6 p.m. It's our regular scheduled monthly meeting. I'm going to call the meeting to order at 6:02. Can we please stand for the Pledge of Allegiance? I pledge allegiance the United States of America, to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Okay, thank you. Move on to item number three, roll call. Will the clerk call the roll, please?
Gino Di Giovanni,
Here.
Brian Capolo,
Here.
Dana Florenza,
Here.
Carly Peck,
Here.
Carlene Galuzzi.
Here.
Record should reflect you have five members present, so you have a quorum.
Okay, thank you. We'll move on to number five, approval of minutes. We're currently working on that to get caught up. We had a meeting with Linda, and we're working to get these minutes resolved. Can I have a motion to table, please?
So moved.
Okay, thank you. We'll move on to number five, public portion. Anybody on Zoom can unmute your mic and just state your name and address for the record. And then if anybody in the public here would wish to speak, you could just walk up to the podium. We'll hit the center button. It'll light up green. State your name and your address for the record, and you could speak. Anyone from the public wish to speak? Dave?
Am I on?
You're on.
Dave Condon,
Green for go.
50 Beatrice Drive, West Haven, Connecticut. Formerly born on Minerva Street, my connection to Derby. Just want to give you an update on all the stuff we've been working on with the 501c3 and the follow-up of the last meeting with thanks to Matt's suggestion, Matt Wielanders. Believe it or not, we've been the 503 has been in place long enough where we had to file our first annual, our first 990 report with the feds, which we did, and it was approved. We had to file our second, our first report with the state, and that was approved. And we just had to file the forms to maintain our status as a public charity, and that was approved. So we're in good shape for another year. I did follow up after our last meeting and spoke with the president of the organization, New Haven Association for Performing Arts, New Haven Center for the Performing Arts. It's a fantastic discussion. They oversee the Schubert, the Tennis Center, and a number of other theaters. Very excited about partnering with us. And so I arranged, told her once we get the report from Steinberg Hart, we know what it's going to cost us. We'll then put the fundraising plan together and build out the 501c3 board, but we want to get her up and into the building ASAP because they're very excited about working with us. So everything we were supposed to do for the 501c3 is in place. Once we get the final report, I'll tear it apart and go ahead and do the fundraising plan, which will take a while because it's a fairly sizable project. And then we're going to be actively recruiting members to the board of directors for the 501c3. Then we'll write the fundraising plan as to how we're going to raise the money. Prayer will be included in that plan because we're going to need as many prayers as we can get to raise this kind of money. And we'll be good to go. So that's the update on the 501c3. Any questions?
Not from us, not from me. Any other questions for Dave? Thank you, Dave.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else from the public that wish to speak? If you're on Zoom, you could just unmute your mic, state your name and address. Anyone else from the public wish to speak? Third and last time?
Yes, speak, but after the presentation.
No. It's only in the public portion. Sure. And if you have any questions after the fact, Gary, you could just email it to us and we'll send you.
That's cool. I'm Gary Collins. I live in Derby. I don't want to give my address because people might owe me money. I'm at 273 Derby Avenue. This is all going great. I've been to some of these meetings. It's working out well. I'm concerned about the Sterling Opera House because it's important for Derby. Make Derby a better place. It's actually a city, but I've heard make Derby a better place. At any rate, there's a lot of revenue that can come in from the Opera House. As this gentleman knows, a lot of us know, there's a lot of good things, revenue for restaurants, revenue for this and that. My concern is the administration currently getting behind this. And I'm not talking about going on Main Street with a free beer sign. I'm talking about getting involved with this, the current administration. I have understanding that the mayor, the current city mayor, has been invited to these meetings and has yet to attend. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I've got the wrong information. I don't know. But I'd like to see this administration more involved in this. We've got names here. I just asked if there were any aldermen or alderwomen here, and the answer was no. Maybe they're over there in the box. I don't know that. But we have names in this city, Garofalo, DeMartino, very important names that I think need to get involved with this, get behind it, put posts up on Facebook, get involved with this thing because it's important. The people in the city on a bipartisan basis are very familiar with those names, and the aldermen and the president and the Congress and all of that. And I think it's important. So my reason for being here right now is to try to get the current administration behind this program. It's important. You people have been working for a long time on this. It's important to get the people of Derby behind it. Other areas, this gentleman has gone out and done a lot of work. But it's important for this current administration to get behind this. I'd like to see it, but I'd like to see that, a lot more of it. I'd like to see the mayor down here. He's been invited. Mark is here, but I think your position right now, Mark, is not to be on the cell phone, but to be the clerk. And he hasn't even looked. So that's my position. Thank you.
Thank you. And just for the record, on Zoom, I see Alderman, Alderwoman Sarah Witamowski, and I think that's it, just to answer your question. Okay, anybody else wish to speak from the public? Anyone else from the public wish to speak? If there's anyone on Zoom for the third and last time, just unmute your mic and state your name and address. Okay, hearing none, motion to close the public portion.
So moved.
Second. All in favor? Okay, so we'll move on to number six. Number six is old business. Report on the on our meeting with Linda Fusco on 6/26/26. So at our last meeting, we had some entities inquire about running events for fundraising events through the Sterling Opera House. Along with Mike at Twisted Vine, we've done these events in the past. So myself and Dana reached out to Linda. We had a meeting with Linda in regards to it. And basically the conclusion of our meeting was that she spoke with the mayor and that the only way any events can take place, if it's a citywide event, just like we did for the 350th or Derby Day in the past. So we'll have to make some adjustments to people that inquire and, you know, like the walking tours that we had and whatnot. So we'll just adjust. We'll adjust that. So at least we have a answer on where to go from there. Any questions on that?
One.
You can't, Dave. Yeah, the public portion, it's over. Any questions or comment from the committee? Okay. If not, we're going to go on to new business. So Steinberg Hart is here. Evan is here. Evan and his team have been working on this study for a while, and Evan's going to report and do a presentation for us on the final findings. Evan, you take it away.
Very good. Let me share my screen. I'm Evandeli Paoli. I'm a principal and architect with Steinberg Hart. Our firm has led the comprehensive study process for the Sterling Opera House. It's not just me, a part of the team, but a larger team of consultants that have collaborated on the overall work. Steinberg Hart, we're based in New York City. In the overall process, we're joined by Web Management, also in New York, who have served as an arts advisory consultant. They've done good market assessment analysis of the local arts market in the Derby region and beyond for the overall study. Stages Consultants out of Highland Park, New Jersey, for our theater consulting and acoustics consulting portions of the study. We're joined by Kohler Ronan Engineers out of Danbury, Connecticut, who we've done much work, particularly on arts and cultural work. For mechanical, electrical, plumbing, fire protection, engineering. And so they've been responsible for those portions of the study. KCI, formerly McLaren Engineers for structural assessment, really good structural engineers based out of New York, not only on the technical side, but are deeply steeped in entertainment engineering and historic buildings like the Sterling. And last but not least, Cost Plus Consultants, who are our cost estimating consulting firm for the study, who have multiple offices. We've been working directly with their St. Petersburg, Florida office, but they have folks around the country. And again, they bring expertise not only in historic buildings like the Sterling, but the nuances and of arts and cultural performing arts projects. So the information that I share with you this evening is the collective findings of this wider team. Beyond just the architects. To talk a little bit about the study process, I've talked about this before to some groups, but the overall study focused primarily on three areas. A market needs assessment, first and foremost, to help judge the nature of the local arts market. Web Management studied things like 30 and 50 minute drive times from the Sterling to understand competitor venues in the local market and other aspects of the market to really understand what the Sterling should be best suited for in its future and how best likely to attract audiences from those local areas. Of course, an existing conditions assessment. We walked through the building multiple times throughout the study, assessing various aspects of the existing construction from the architectural side, from the mechanical, electrical, plumbing side. There's not a whole lot there in the existing building on that front. Much of that will be new, but nonetheless, on that front as well. Structural aspects, acoustics, and specialized theater planning components of all of that. So, an existing conditions assessment was what we'll call this middle portion of the work. And resulting from those two sets of findings, ultimately, we've made a set of recommendations for what capital improvements should be defined in the overall renovation that are backed by the findings from the market needs assessment to best give you the footing you need moving forward with the types of improvements, renovations to the building that would be backed by likely income, return on investment, and financial logic as you move forward into the future. And so the study focused on those three primary areas. I'll talk a little bit more about the market needs assessment, part of the study and the process that Web Management worked through. They evaluated forces and trends within the local area and just an overall review of what current trends in the arts. Sure. No problem.
You could just go to mute, Mark.
I should say, Web Management and Stages Consultants were both two of the firms involved in the 2002 study for the Sterling. So they have background in the building, but nonetheless, it being over 20 years since the market had been reviewed relative to the Sterling, it was important to take a new look at what the current arts market means. Again, as I reviewing the competitor venues, there were a total of 38 venues that Web Management identified in their part of the report that ranged from performance facilities, cinemas, meeting and event spaces, What that found is that there were a common venue size of about 1,500, sort of mid-large sized venues within that group of competing venues, but an opening in the smaller, say, less than 1,500, but more than 300 sized capacity. This is important because obviously it factors into the seating capacity that the Sterling can accommodate, which I'll come back to a little bit later in the presentation. But we feel good about that information because we think the Sterling can, in fact, fill a gap and a need within your community and region. And then, of course, user demand and the likely types of performances that the local region would want to come and pay ticket pricing to see performances. And there are a variety of different types of sort of secondary uses. The primary use that the market study determined would be best suited for the Sterling would be presented live arts and entertainment, comedy, popular music, and those types of events would be likely the primary uses. But of course, this is a multi-purpose theater and can accommodate a variety of secondary uses as well. Such as nonprofit rentals, commercial rentals, film, education programs, and community gatherings to help keep the building active. And I think one of the most important things that we've been trying to determine and plan for is how to keep the building as activated as we can once it reopens on day one. That there's not just a singular use, but a variety of uses that can be planned for to keep audiences and groups in the building. And so the outcome, again, as I from the market needs assessment, recommended use commercial entertainment, live music, comedy, those types of uses. Next steps beyond the market needs assessment, and much of what the 501c3 is now embarking on has started to do some of this, but from Webb's study, two recommendations and that they offer. One, completing a business plan. So the market needs assessment did a good overview of the capacity and what the local market can support, but really understanding the operational business plan for the venue moving forward would tell you well into the future, beyond opening day on day one, how venue operations can be planned for financially. So completing a business plan is an important next step to begin planning, not only for the physical renovation, but beyond. And then three, finding an operator, an operating partner, which will be a little bit later in the process, but clearly a partner that the city can put an RFP out to seek partnership with, the type of entity that would actually run the day-to-day operations of the city in the of the venue. Webb's study recommends five key steps in doing so. Building a list of organizations and contacts that might be known within the area, developing and publishing an RFP. This is something that Webb management could assist with if needed. Evaluating respondents, so bringing a critical eye to the types of folks that respond to the operating partner RFP opportunity. And then once a operating partner is ultimately selected, forming an MOU, a memorandum of understanding with that entity of how the operations of the venue would be conducted. And once the physical capital improvement renovations are underway, that MOU is something that would then transition into a lease agreement for that operating partner. So in a big summary, holistic view, those five steps for finding an operator, but the likely way that the venue would be run into the future. Moving beyond the market needs assessment and looking at some of the physical assessment of the building, we started by really taking a deep dive into the available area in the existing building. So this chart up on the screen, you don't need to read all the details, but it evaluated each enclosed space within the overall Sterling Opera House building. There are a multitude of floors from basement, street level, below stage, orchestra level, first and second balconies. In total, all areas indicate a building of about 28,000 gross square feet. And within that shell of the existing building, about 18,000 or just shy of 19,000 square feet of usable space. And so this was our assessment to understand if the interior of the building is reused for future uses, how much available space is there truly to use for those new functions? Primarily, again, performing arts venue, but evaluating what support spaces and other spaces that the building may not have currently that it would need in the future for a true venue. Looking at the existing conditions for the exterior, the city has previously kept up well with the maintenance of the exterior of the building. Our findings did not find significant challenges with the exterior beyond some typical things you would expect to see in a building of this age from the late 1800s. There's some brick efflorescence that you can see on the north facade and other areas of the building. Again, things that could be resolved through repointing of brick and other modest updates to the exterior that we've planned for in the confines of the study. There were two site survey. An updated site survey was done as part of the study process. You can see here the previous survey was done in the 70s, an updated survey done more recently that confirmed the building is a zero lot line site, meaning that the property line of the Sterling is right up to the exterior brick facade on all four sides of the building. And so thinking about that, I'll talk a little bit in a moment about what that means for future use and additional areas within the Sterling and what that means for potential rethinking of adjacent areas adjacent to the building. Continuing on the interior of the existing building, looking at the street level and basement, the types of deterioration we saw here expected. Lead paint peeling, the types of things that would need to be abated in an ultimate construction project. But overall, the interior of the building seemed dry, free of rot, free of decay, free of some of the more substantial types of deterioration that many buildings of this age would typically see. So we were pleased to see that we wouldn't be dealing with that more extensive type of decay that you would need to deal with water infiltration coming into the building. Much of that is attributed to just the continued overall maintenance of the exterior, the roof, and the building facade over time. Looking at the interior of the existing building, one of the primary hallmark features of the audience chamber itself is this very intimate horseshoe-shaped balcony. It's a very intimate room. While it's a larger capacity audience, it's one that really focuses the audience and all of the seats towards the stage. And so in our recommendations moving forward, this is a very important part to keep. I will say, not to go into code, building code details, but the Connecticut building code, as well as the existing building code, allow us to keep historic elements of the existing building intact. And that's a good portion of the finding, that we do not need to rework or replace those elements in the building that would be deemed historic. We may refurbish them, we may repair them, we may recreate them in kind, but we're able to salvage and keep much of what makes the interior of the Sterling so special. And similar types of modest decay to the plaster on the interior front of house lobby areas that you can see here, the areas along Elizabeth Street that have the main stairs that bring audience members up to the chamber itself. The Sterling Opera House is a unique venue in that the main audience levels of the building are in the air. They're up off of street, not at street level. And so part of our evaluation was also looking at accessibility, how we move audience members vertically in the building to get to the second floor level from street into the main chamber. The structural assessment, as I referred to a moment ago, our team at KCI McLaren, we're looking at much of the structural components. The existing building is all wood framed, timber framed, with a few areas of select cast iron columns in the lower audience chambers and basement, and otherwise supported by load-bearing brick masonry walls on all four sides. And so part of our assessment had to take into context the this makeup of construction. There's significant wood framing, and obviously wood presents some challenges in and of itself, being a fire risk, life safety concerns. We wanted to make sure that overall the wood can be maintained because there's so much of it that makes up the existing building. And again, with our code assessment and review, the wood can be preserved. and left in the building as it is. There are many areas in the building where some of the surface plaster has deteriorated or fallen off the wall, fallen off of the existing lath. It would be replaced and repaired in similar methods as had been used in the 1800s and the original construction. Mechanical, electrical, plumbing systems. Again, there aren't much here in the form of these systems. Not surprisingly, really, all of the MEP, as we call it, systems would be new as part of the renovation project for HVAC, for electrical, for basic building plumbing, for sprinkler and fire protection. Sprinkler and fire protection would be expanded. There are some existing lines, in fact, that are in the basement, but that would need to be expanded through the audience chamber and the rest of the building for life safety. And as part of the reason we're able to keep the wood framing that we've looked at. The existing acoustics, obviously, there are deterioration and other plaster wall surfaces that have fallen apart a bit over time. And so the existing acoustics need to be brought back to what they had been. So surfaces like the underside of the balcony in the orchestra level that is open to the wood framing, wall surfaces that you can see in the small image on the top right on the screen that are fully exposed to the load-bearing brick, would come back in with new plaster to reinstate the type of construction that had been in the room to begin with. One of the things that hadn't been in the building previously, obviously, was HVAC and cooling and conditioning. Part of the design of the HVAC systems that would be new to the building would be looking at fan noise, ductwork routing, and minimizing the type of mechanical sounds that would be otherwise introduced to a building that hadn't had that previously. So again, keeping mechanical noise to a minimum as those systems come into the building. The Sterling is listed on the National Register of Historic Places. We've looked at, as part of the study, what would be involved in pursuing historic tax credits for the project. There are a multitude of principles and processes that would need to be followed that the study sets us up to do in the future. Needing to meet the Secretary of Interior standards for the type of renovation and the characteristics of what would be put back, which has a lot to do with preservation of character of the original building, authenticity of materials, and compatible additions. You'll see in a moment, part of the study does in fact recommend a small elevator addition to the building to deal with access and other challenges that would otherwise be very difficult to build into the confines of the four brick walls that make up the Sterling. For the next steps beyond the study, when this becomes a true full design and building project, in the future, next steps beyond the study, there are three phases that would be pursued for pursuing the historic tax credits. Phase one is an evaluation, submitting the types of data that were produced out of the study, refined for an initial submission both to the Historic Connecticut State Historic Preservation Office as well as the National Park Service for review and assessment that, yes, in fact, the Sterling qualifies as a historic building, not only for its National Register entry, but for all of the other characteristics that it embodies. That evaluation would also outline the vision for the renovation that would take place. A second phase submission for the tax credits would take place during the design process, part of the way through, while the construction documents for the renovation are being prepared. And obviously a third phase, it deals with evaluation of the completed work. Once the renovation is complete, the State Historic Preservation Office and National Park Service would review the outcome of the completed work for compliance with the submitted construction documents and all other criteria. And so a lot of our study document also evaluates the Sterling's possibility for making sure we're meeting these criteria, particularly of the Secretary of Interior's standards for rehabilitation. I'll move next into our third category of what the study focused on, really the capital improvement recommendations for the renovation. I talked a moment ago about the building areas in the overall building. 18 or 19,000 usable square feet in the building. Our team at Stages Consultants worked together with us to evaluate and generate a conceptual building program for additional spaces that would be needed for running a venue of this type. The street level of the building, former City Hall, has the former chamber spaces, the former clerk's office, the mayor's office, jail cells, other types of spaces that lend themselves well for rethinking and reusing for dressing rooms, production offices, and other types of support spaces that would be critical for running a venue, a performing arts venue of this type. And so what we've charted here, I won't go into detail, but again, in that similar fashion, on the left-hand column is tracking modest spaces that would be attributed to a new addition, the elevator addition, and all of the repurposed spaces in the existing building. And so when we come to the bottom line of how much square footage the resultant building would have, about 20,000 net square feet of usable interior space for the renovation. So we're currently, there's about 18 usable within the building shell. We're trying to be more efficient and find ways of repurposing space where it exists, and about 800 square feet in the elevator addition. So the much smaller, more modest space attributed to the elevator and the addition adjacent to the building. I'll next pull up this image. I'll enlarge this for those on the screen and those in the room. But this is a site plan diagram illustrating not only the Sterling, but the adjacent buildings. On the top of the screen, where my cursor is Elizabeth Street. The bottom, Olivia Street. North is to the left for those.
That's like City Hall?
No, the courthouse.
Oh.
Better orientation. You can see the colored areas at the center of this image are the Sterling Opera House footprint. And what the site plan outlines is the adjacent space needed for the elevator addition and what would need to be pursued as a variance for an easement for elevator addition and accessible entry. We've outlined here a zone of about 10 feet from the existing face of building for, again, coming from Elizabeth Street westward to Olivia, a new accessible entry and ramp and access stairs to what would be a public lobby at street level. Immediately adjacent to that, we've located an elevator that would be two-sided. It would serve both front of house functions and audience access up to the orchestra, the balcony one and balcony two areas of the audience, as well as back of house functions, connecting dressing rooms, support spaces for the stage, and ultimately a loading dock that would come in off of Olivia Street. And so we're trying to be very efficient in how we plan access to the building. The reason why we've recommended it be in addition to the building is the sheer disruption an elevator core like this would pose to the existing wood structure and those types of challenges. We also don't want to build more lifts and elevators than we have to. And so it's serving double duty. As we come further towards Olivia Street, recommendations for a small loading dock, exterior equipment pads for HVAC equipment, an electrical transformer. A single loading drive would be possible for vehicles up to larger tractor trailers, as well as box trucks and vans and smaller vehicles that might need to access the loading dock, getting equipment into stage. New curb cut, obviously, at Olivia Street to allow that drive to happen. And what the diagram is illustrating are two clear circulation zones adjacent to those easement zones that would be maintained on both sides of the building, the north side and through adjacent to the courthouse to Olivia Street, as well as the south edge of the building straight through from Elizabeth to Olivia Street. I'll move through some of the new proposed building plans for the Sterling, starting from the lowest levels of the building up through the highest. The lower level of the building really is not suited well for accessibility and other challenges, but does offer great opportunity for equipment, for infrastructure, for HVAC, for plumbing piping, and things that really shouldn't go elsewhere and would be best suited lower in the building and consolidated in this fashion. The lower building would be, the lower floor would be more utilitarian. As we move upward to street level, Elizabeth Street is on the right-hand side of this image, proposing both keeping the existing entry off of Elizabeth Street, the historic portico and entry off of Elizabeth Street. You can see just to the bottom of that, an area for the new accessible ramp and stairs, getting folks into what would be a new opened up main lobby space at street level. The existing historic stair, again, our findings through code review allow us to keep all of the existing stairs as they are. Great news for railings and other historic aspects of the original building. The stair would be opened up to the public lobby at this floor level. You can see in the blue colors and green colors, a lot of the blue and green are production focused spaces like AV rooms and tool rooms, things that support stage. In green, dressing rooms and performer lounge for the performers themselves. And so there's a dual function of this floor, both front of house, mostly in yellow, with public restrooms in the pink areas down at this floor, as well as back of house support for the stage above. As we move up, there's a small area immediately below the stage, a partial floor before we get to the audience chamber itself, because of its adjacency to the stage. Again, mostly performer focused for dressing rooms, performer restrooms, and those functions for quick changes and quick access to stage that might need to happen. As we move up to the first floor of the audience chamber itself, you can see on the far right-hand side in yellow, the main stairs and lobby that bring you up from the main entry at Elizabeth Street to the orchestra level. On the bottom side of the screen, you can see in yellow the elevator vestibule and connection into the main chamber floor. We have a main seating area at the orchestra level. I'll defer for a moment in talking about audience seating capacity, but the majority of audience, maybe about half of the audience capacity, would be located at the orchestra floor. At the far corners of the room, proposing that there are small concessions, food and beverage possibilities, generating secondary revenue, not just from tickets, but food and beverage opportunities is important to give you these options of flexibility of where the revenue is coming from in the future. At the rear of the room would be a new equipment booth for lighting and sound, something that does not exist in the existing room, but would be very important for new equipment for those things coming into the hall itself. On the stage, and again, to improve access to and from the balconies, dealing with life safety, how to move folks efficiently and quickly from those upper areas of the building, we've proposed two exit stairs at the rear of the stage. This is required for life safety and exiting from the upper floors of the balcony. By inserting these stair cores at the rear of the stage, it also simplifies some of the structural reinforcement that would have to happen to the stage level, to the upper gallery levels and other areas in the wood-framed stage. At the rear of the stage area, we have piano storage, and again, to adjacent stage left, stage right, connecting corridors between the front of house and back of house to get folks to the stairs at the rear of the stage. And again, connecting at the side stage area to the elevator for access. As we move up to balcony one, the format and arrangement of the audience is very similar to the level below, where the public lobby and stairs fronts along Elizabeth Street. We have a side access for wheelchair and handicapped access up to balcony one, with ramped access into the rear row, where we would have removable handicapped seats for those audience members. Two additional concessions areas are possible at the rear of balcony one. And again, a similar arrangement where we have the exit stairs at the rear of the stage, storage for backstage equipment, and the connecting corridors between the balcony and those exit stairs. Moving up to balcony two, a similar format, we're locating additional public restrooms at the rear of balcony two. And so again, the main public restrooms will be located at street level, serving the street level lobby and orchestra floor above. Balcony two and balcony one would be served by the restrooms up at balcony two. And the reason we've done so is to minimize disruption to the balcony, the first balcony level, and the seating area immediately inside the chamber. You can imagine that this floor level, additional restrooms, carving out additional space within the chamber would significantly alter both the balcony, its shaping, and the available volume and capacity in the audience chamber. And so the primary restrooms, street level, and balcony two. The attic level, really the open area above the chamber itself of wood rafters and trusses, and the mechanical room, a new mechanical room that would be located above the stage. Most of the mechanical equipment that would be proposed for the renovation is small, packaged units with exterior condensers, things that can happen in phased implementation without running large amounts of ductwork and things that would be disruptive to the building, with the exception of the main air handler, a new air handler that would condition the audience chamber and stage, which would be located up at this level, at the high point of the stage house. It would serve both the stage and be fed through the attic space to condition the audience chamber. The stairs that come up to this level as well give us, again, the benefit of simplifying the structural support of the equipment that would be located up at this level. And so, in totality, this is a cross section through the building, looking on the right hand side from Elizabeth Street. Left hand side is the Olivia Street side of the building. This gives you a sort of broad summary of the things I just spoke about. At the very bottom of this image is that lower level of utility and mechanical infrastructure. At street level, which is the next level up, the public lobby and additional back of house space. Once arriving into the chamber, it is a multi-story space, both with the orchestra level, balcony one and balcony two. You can see again on the right-hand side the multi-story stairs that bring access up to the balconies. And on the stage itself, both the below stage performer areas in green, as well as the stage footprint at the left-hand side of the image. To talk a little bit more about the stage environment itself, we wanted to both assess the existing and what future possibilities might be possible within the stage house footprint. This image just delineates and summarizes a few of the components that we have in the existing stage. You could see here in this section, again, it's all wood-framed, both the side galleries, which are these lower platforms. This is a cross-section through the stage house in a different direction, looking towards the audience. So imagine you're standing on stage, looking towards the audience in this drawing on the in the center of the slide. But the point being that there are very limited existing rigging and gallery points in the existing stage house. The side galleries and the upper grid are all wood framed, something we would typically do out of steel and much heavier structure and construction today. And so that gave us a reference point of, where do we take this, to what extreme, and what makes the most sense for the Stirling stage moving into the future. We can imagine taking this stage and doing something that you might see, for instance, in a Broadway house where it's a fully rigged gridiron and more complex type of rigging system on one extreme, and perhaps something that's a little more simplified and better supporting the true likely uses for the stage into the future. These diagrams illustrate some of the components that would be needed to have what code considers and defines a true stage to be. In blue would be a true fire-rated proscenium wall from the foundations up to the very top of the building, something that does not exist currently. The existing proscenium is all wood-framed. It gave us a lot of topics to review during the study to make sure that that is not a point of life safety concern moving into the future. There's a lot of potential cost that could be affiliated with redoing the proscenium wall to accommodate the larger, more expansive rigging systems. So a point of a topic of concern that we reviewed during the study. These additional components that you see numbered on the screen, mostly in green, relate to much of what this diagram talks about, which is additional gallery levels and structural support steel for what would be needed for a full gridiron. Let me talk about this at a high level, but additional galleries, both stage left and stage right, at the fly gallery level, steel structure for loading gallery level, and full steel gridiron up at the top, very top of the stage house. This is a challenge too with some of the found space that we needed for HVAC equipment at the very top of the stage. You can see here some of the vertical height that would be needed to implement this type of system is actually beyond the confines of the gable roof of the existing stage. There are a variety of challenges that could come about by implementing a rigging system of this expanse. It also does not give us the benefit of ease of exiting our audience members through the side stage areas and the rear of the stage. And so what we've recommended is a stage footprint slightly reduced, in fact, from its current footprint. Wing space side to side of the stage of 11 feet wide and 20 feet deep, a main playing area that you can see in this diagram in the darker red color, 20 feet by 28 feet, essentially a stage depth of 20 feet, a playing area of 20 feet, 28 feet wide. What that would be supplemented with is a pipe grid rigging infrastructure overhead, a more modest version of the more expansive system that I had up in the previous slide, but one that gives you flexibility for hanging stage drops and other types of equipment, speakers, lighting within the stage environment for the variety of uses that I described earlier. In this image, you can see at the rear of the stage, which is the far back of the diagram, the two stair towers in orange and the side areas that would be adjacent to the wings for connecting, exiting through the through to the audience. And so as we look at a similar diagram here of the stage, you can see an orange on the stage left and stage right sides, those connective corridor areas at stage and up through balcony one, and in blue, the upper mechanical room floor for the new HVAC equipment, as well as the pipe grid structure directly below that, that would be provided with chain hoists and other equipment to allow the raising and lowering of the grid and attachment of other devices, performance devices therein. The study looked at exiting requirements and overall capacity of the building, essentially dictating that within the audience capacity and the street levels of the building, there are about 770 total occupants within all of the new spaces, the audience chamber itself, that would be allowable by building code through all the variety of spaces in the building. This allowed us to right size, say, the stairs and other circulation components within the recommendations. In these diagrams, we've also looked at what would have to come out from the building, what would need to be demolished and removed in a delicate way to make way for the new construction, particularly the stairs and egress on stage at the basement level, this far upper image. Not a whole lot would need to be removed. Penetrations for piping and those types of things would need to take place at street level. There are two different elevations at street level heights that would need to be leveled to allow a contiguous floor between the Elizabeth Street side and the Olivia Street side of the building to make those accessible and usable. The below stage area has existing partitions and walls that would need to be removed to be reconfigured for dressing rooms and those types of spaces. On the stage itself, existing wood framing within the area and footprint of the two new stairs would need to be removed to allow construction of concrete block walls that would support the perimeter of the new stairs. That concrete block, again, works well efficiently for us to brace the stage floor in particular to the new construction so that performers don't have sway and sag on what is the existing wood. Both balconies, again, are wood framed. They're row to row depth for the audience seating. It's much shallower than you would see in theaters of today. There is possibility our structural team evaluated the soundness of the superstructure of the balcony, meaning the columns and the main beams that support those floors are in good shape to be reinforced and allow the respacing of those seating tiers on that existing structure to give us some flexibility with how we lay out new seating tiers in the future on those levels. It's a delicate balance, obviously. The deeper the row-to-row spacing is in those areas, the fewer audience members we can seat. I'll come back to that in a moment, but should note that the point of the study leaves open that possibility of exactly where the tiers want to be spaced to and what possibilities there are for audience size balanced with comfort and row-to-row depth. The building, the study walked through an assessment of both the existing architectural assemblies, the walls, the floors, the ceilings, the plaster assemblies within these diagrams to talk about existing load-bearing masonry walls. We have 3 layers thick, in fact, in most places of load-bearing masonry. It's even thicker around structural columns and other load-bearing, heavy load-bearing areas. Areas where we have existing plaster in the existing building around wood-framed walls, but also making recommendations for new assemblies and things that would have to come into the building in the form of new plaster walls that we built in kind. We may be using metal lath in place of wood lath that had been used back in the day, but nonetheless, coming back with plaster wall construction to have a net neutral impact to the building acoustics and other criteria. You can see here in this diagram on the screen a take on what would be needed to respace the balcony tiers. This is a cross-section showing the main raker beam through the existing balcony, the wood existing wood framing that would need to be altered to create deeper row-to-row spacing for the audience seats. Talking a little bit more about the seats themselves and the capacity, we've in the study outlined 3 options for seating capacities, and again, falling well within where we think there's a gap in the overall market for a venue of this size, but a seating capacity ranging from, say, 613 seats to 550, based on different layouts. It's always a trade-off. So it's a trade-off between compactness and density of the seats, density of row-to-row spacing, and how packed we are designing the audience chamber, versus how deep we make rows, how large we make seats for audience comfort. And so we've left open that possibility that could be further evaluated in the future, particularly when there's an operator on board, when there's better assessment about ticket pricing and business model behind how many seats need to be filled in the audience. The first option for the audience seating, again, totals about 613 seats between the orchestra level, balcony one, and balcony two. It says that we maintain what had been what's called a continental seating layout on the orchestra level, the far left of this slide, where the access walking aisles to the seats are on the far sides of the room, and the rows are therefore deeper to enter and get to your seat. It's an efficient way of seating layout, getting us about 235 seats at the orchestra level, but of course has the trade-off of a longer walk to one seat if you're seated in the center orchestra, for instance. Balcony one and balcony two are left in this option with their existing row-to-row depth, about 2'8" or 32 inches, a little shallower than we would see today. We would typically see 36 or higher in our row-to-row spacing, but nonetheless, trying to study how many on the high end of audience seat count we could get to, about 214 seats in this center diagram at balcony one, and a similar strategy at balcony two yields about 164 seats. So option one for the seating, 613 seats. Option two prioritizes rethinking the orchestra level and introducing, instead of the continental seating that I mentioned a moment ago, two intermediate access aisles for better access and flow to the center orchestra. The trade-off is the loss of maybe 30 seats or so at the orchestra level by doing that, but again, is a topic that can be evaluated in further detail in the future in conjunction with ticket pricing and other aspects. At the balcony level, this again illustrates keeping the existing tiers as they are at the 214 seats and 164 seats, this option yielding in the middle of the ranges about 569 seats. And in option three, we've kept the orchestra at Continental to maximize seat capacity in that floor level, but have recommended or looked at in this option deepening the rows from a shallower row to a 3-foot row. We lose some seats in the balconies by doing so, 179 seats where there were 214 prior. As an example, 136 seats in balcony two where there had been 164. So again, the purpose is to make sure that at the end of the study, we're not locking you into one prescriptive way forward, but giving recommendations for a variety of different ways that the seat arrangement can be taken into the future. Talking a little bit about acoustics, obviously the study looked in depth about isolating from the exterior. We have the benefit of mass masonry brick walls that are good isolation from the exterior. A bigger concern to be studied in the future is really sound emanating from the venue itself to your surrounding neighbors. That could be a topic that needs to be evaluated further, depending again on the determined use and the sound energy generated therein. The HVAC was also studied acoustically to make recommendations for the types of equipment that would keep mechanical noise to a minimum. There are also recommendations for what are called variable acoustics. We know that the venue could change in use from live music. There could be non-amplified events, natural acoustic events in the room, as well as those that are mic'd that would need dampening, something besides just the plaster wall surfaces. There are both static as well as mechanized ways of treating the variable room acoustics with mechanisms that can, in fact, drop fabric sound absorbers into the room for those purposes, which would be recommended for that type of use. The structure, I'll hit at a high level again. One of the findings for the stage was that the existing joists are well suited as they are, but for new code required stage floor loading would have greater sag than code allows. The stairs that we've implemented help reduce the span from the front of the stage to the back of stage and address much of the sagging that the stage floor would go through. The building, thankfully, has many areas where the plaster has fallen off, which has yielded our team the ability to see up close the structure behind what would normally be hidden. Therefore, we were able to evaluate further the supporting floor, particularly of the orchestra level. We would have the greatest audience capacity and the greatest number of occupants in the building to understand where in this diagram the major support beams are, the diagonal beams that you see in red, are located, and therefore the types of joist spacing and floor structure that exist above them. We know that the joists are sized well enough. They may need to be reinforced with additional construction for the anticipated load at the orchestra floor and upper audience floors. Again, some images, an evaluation of the existing floor joists that our team measured throughout the building, including the lower levels up through the upper. You can see in the lower right-hand image an example of one of the cast iron columns in the lower areas of the building that help support not only the orchestra floor, but the gravity loads from the balcony levels coming down through the building. Mechanical systems, electrical systems, there are a variety of different types of equipment for each of these that have been recommended. Our teams have evaluated the capacity of these systems for a mechanical total tonnage of about 100 tons for the overall systems. Again, smaller units recommended throughout the vast majority, split units that would be serving the individual rooms within, for instance, the street level of the building in the smaller areas. The condensers for that equipment would normally be a sound concern that we can locate outside of the building, as I illustrated within the site plan a few slides prior. The electrical capacity and the electrical services in the building are fully new. There is all kinds of existing panels and copper wiring and other types of things in the existing building that would have to be removed for all new systems, new panels that are not just providing the capacity for sort of the basic building systems and lighting, but also anticipation for performance systems, theatrical lighting systems, and dimming for the chamber itself and the stage, the AV systems that complement the performance environment within the venue. Plumbing systems too would all be new, supporting restrooms within the front of house and the back of house dressing room areas, as well as fire protection for sprinkler that would run throughout the building and more expansively throughout the audience chamber and stage. Before we talk a little bit about cost and some of the evaluation of pricing that our team has reviewed, we want to talk a little bit about the strategy for phasing. Of course, we can look at the project as an all-in-one approach of doing all of these areas. What is most important as a recommendation coming from the study is doing what minimal work is needed to get folks back in the door day one and assessing what work can then happen thereafter for subsequent improvements and upgrades. There's a lot, I will preface that to say there is still a lot of work that would have to happen day one to bring audiences back in the door. But nonetheless, we wanted to make sure before we embarked on the cost estimate part of the study that we structure the cost estimate in those phases. So phase one is the area that you see on the screen in orange. It's illustrating, again, a cross section through the building, looking at the stage house on the left-hand side. And on the right-hand side of the image, again, is Elizabeth Street. But in orange are all of the public areas, all of the chamber, audience chamber areas, and the areas affiliated with the stage as a first initial phase to get the venue reopened and audiences back in the door. We've broken out in a second phase in blue, the area immediately below the stage, which perhaps doesn't have to happen immediately for those dressing rooms that I showed a moment ago. And then the street level itself in purple, yet below that, is in some ways its own confined area within the building that could happen in a distinct phase. The mechanical systems and infrastructure are designed to be implemented on a per-phase basis, meaning only the equipment needed for that respective phase. We need to come into the building day one, and it's expandable as we go into day two, so we're not spending money more than once to redo systems and work that was done in an earlier phase. And of course, the loading dock, the exterior work could happen yet again in a separate element, a separate phase of work in the future. So, and at a high level, looking at that summary. At street level, again, this is switching orientation view to a plan view, a bird's eye view of the building. Looking again at street level, where Elizabeth Street is on the right-hand side of this image, Olivia Street side towards the left, is illustrating a little bit more at a nuanced level what the initial construction would need to undertake. In orange at street level are all of the front of house lobby functions, the elevator addition. In the purple work, the second phase that could happen later down the road for production and performer support. In the diagonal hatched area between the purple and the orange, the connective tissue that would need to still happen day one to allow movement from the initial build out in the orange area through to the exit stairs that would have to be built as part of phase one. So the phasing not only happens in those big groupings, but it's also a little bit more nuanced in that way. And again, here you can see the upper floors of the building. Most of those areas would happen in the initial phase one portion of the work. This is again the exterior site plan, just again illustrating the outside areas in green, that loading drive with loading dock that could happen separately, and two exterior areas, both for a pad area for HVAC equipment. This will be built out, the pad initially as part of phase one, the equipment in subsequent iterations as needed by those phases, and an electrical transformer that would be located at the exterior of the building. Lastly, my last part of the talk today will talk about the cost estimate and all of the detailed information contained within the estimate. The reason why we just went through some of the phasing description is that the costs are arranged in a similar fashion to identify the costs involved in each of those four primary phases that the study has outlined. The cost estimate has looked at a variety of different types of information. Before we get into more detailed information, there are two primary areas of cost that we've been concerned about in the estimate. One that are called hard costs, all of the contractor-related trade costs for the physical construction work associated with the renovation. And this is what we call hard costs, one category that is in the top row of the diagram that you see on the screen here. Below the big blue line on the screen is a second row for soft costs. These are additional fees and permitting costs, professional architectural engineering fees, furnishings. If you imagine the Sterling or any building, tipping it upside down, shaking it out, anything that drops out, loose furnishings, that type of equipment would all be considered as part of soft costs. And so what we're talking about in the cost estimate is really outlining what would be involved for the total project cost, adding both of these hard and soft costs and giving you a good idea of what the all-in number would be for the entire amount of work. This diagram illustrates at a conceptual level, again, the way we've organized the cost estimate into phases. So not only are we reading costs from top to bottom, hard and soft costs, but from left to right in our phase one, which is the getting folks back in the doors of the Sterling day one. Phase 1B, as it's called here, the street level, phase 2A, the below stage dressing rooms, and phase 2B, the exterior work, ultimately getting us to that right-hand column for the total costs of all of that, and ultimately, as I'll show in a moment, the bottom right, which is the total of all of this work. So we've broken down as part of the study not just a single lump sum, but all of the detailed information that get us to the total cost. Let me pull up this diagram again, but now here with some of the numerical cost values. I'll first start with the lower bottom right-hand number, the total cost, hard and soft costs included, the construction costs, the loose permitting fees, the loose furnishings, equipment, all of that work in totality indicate roughly a $37 million project with all of the phases. Again, as we look from phase one on to the right-hand side, the initial build-out that we were imagining would be required to bring audiences back in the doors of the Sterling day one is the largest phase of work. It's about $30 million in total. The subsequent areas represent both smaller footprints within the overall building and smaller areas of cost. What this tells us is that in the future, it could be elected that all of the work is done at once. It might make more financial efficiency sense to do so. But the other packages, phase 1B, 2A, 2B, could be broken out in subsequent areas of work if desired. Phase 1B, again, for the below stage dressing rooms, about a $2 million project to do that work all in. Phase 2A, which is the street level build out of the building for both the public lobbies and the support space, about $3.6 million. And the exterior work for loading dock, the exterior equipment pads, and that work, $1.2 million. The phase 1A also includes the elevator addition to the side of the building for audience and support access for the stage. So at a high level, we wanted to identify these numbers. I'll pull this up. Obviously, the cost estimate that our team has produced is very detailed. It's about a 100-page document that's included within the final study that talk about a variety of sub-costs that are included both within the hard and soft cost areas that I just delineated. And so the chart that's up on the screen, don't strain your eyes. I'll describe this in more detail, but begin to highlight much of those costs and what are included within the larger numbers that I pulled up on the previous slide. We first want to talk a little bit about hard costs. Again, these are the trade subcontractor costs of what it would take to actually do the construction work. Let me enlarge this left-hand side. When we talk about that, there are a variety of costs included within those numbers. From the top of this list, these are typical contractor markups that we would expect to see on the work for this type of project. An allowance for general requirements, the building direct trade cost, that is really the direct cost that you would see on bid day from the individual trade subcontractors. Within this number are specialist equipment allowances. A lot of the theatrical equipment for the building would both come as part of the construction and be permanently built into the building. Some of that equipment is also loose, plug and play, and would fall within what could be bought for the building as future equipment in that format. Think of speakers and microphones, music stands, those types of things. Site development and utilities all bring us to a total direct trade cost number in today's dollars in 2026. We also are including as part of this contingency numbers. We're early, this is while this is a study, there is much work that would happen subsequent to this in a true design project. And so there need to be contingencies covering a variety of different aspects. A design phase contingency of about 17.5%, which we've recommended because, again, we're in a study phase of work for this early conceptual assessment. And within the contingencies, allowance for CM general conditions, insurances, bonds, fees, and permits. Again, these are costs that we would typically see for a project like this. Subcontractor insurance, general liability insurance, builder's risk, fee and permitting values that get us to a total value of the bid cost in today's dollars in 2026. There is an escalation amount that we're carrying on those numbers of about 8.5%, because based on where we are today, if the project were to move immediately subsequent to this into design phases thereafter, it may be as early as 2028 that we would see a bid day. The prices are therefore escalated out to the first quarter of 2028. And these are already included in that initial slide of numbers that I had up a moment ago to make sure that we're safeguarding the estimate, not only in today's dollars, but 2 years from today. And then, of course, construction phase contingency, there's an owner's contingency that these types of projects always carry of about 5%. And so when we're looking again at those hard costs, it's a variety of things, not just the subcontractor number, but escalation and fees and other types of costs that need to be included. Let me again come up to this portion of the slide and talk about another interesting topic, but the graphs that you see at the bottom of the slide talk about where in the building these costs are attributed to. And in the larger portion of these pie, you can see 50% in phase one, about 67%, 69% in the third phase, attributable to mechanical, electrical, plumbing, fire protection, life safety systems. This is not surprising. These are the components of the building that are the most really vacated from the existing building, given its age from the late 1800s. There'd be substantial work in those areas to bring new systems into the building for the future. And so the percentage of the cost that you saw on the previous screen A lot of that, more than half, is attributable to infrastructure, things that you may not see upon opening day and getting into the building day one, but that are very much necessary to allow the building to operate. By comparison, in the pale yellow color that you can see here, 28% in the initial phase, 31%, 26% is really the interior fit out, things that you do see, the plaster wall finishes, the paint finishes, things of that sort. We feel good about where that number is indicating because it means we do not plan, at least for the initial day one, extravagant finishes beyond the means of the project. Again, things that would reinstate the historic nature of the building. We don't believe that the types of finishes in the original building were extravagant and embellished and overly embellished. Nonetheless, the initial interior fit out would be those that bring back the historic character without over embellishing the building. And of course, those types of finishes, if desired, could always happen in the future without impacting any of the work that's done here. The second category that I talked about, soft costs, there are a variety too of categories carried within those dollar amounts. I'll go through those again. We've carried a category for loose furnishings, fixtures, and equipment, everything from the seats that you're sitting in to music stands to front of house lobby benches, these types of furnishings that we've provided an allowance number for based on the types of these types of projects and what might be expected for a conceptual allowance for furnishings. Our team at Stages have also generated a conceptual budget for performance equipment, not only the fixed equipment that we talked about a moment ago, but the loose equipment for performance lighting fixtures, for filler platforms that could serve to extend the orchestra, the stage into the orchestra. If there's a larger event happening, there are loose platforming that can allow the expansion of the playing area into the audience for those types of functions. Loose microphones and cables, that type of equipment is within the budget. Professional fees. When the project moves forward, there are an array of architects, engineers, consultants, theater consultants, acousticians, landscape folks that would be part of the larger design team. The estimate also includes provisions for those fee allowances. An overall abatement allowance. There are, as we know from walking through the building, there are areas of lead paint. There are likely areas of asbestos, particularly at street level, that need to be allowed for in the budget. We've done so here with a 10% contingency to carry that. Miscellaneous costs, things that to provide miscellaneous legal fees and permitting fees if the historic tax credit process is pursued. The permitting fees that are standardized are carried within the budget for this work as well. So that gives you an idea again of the types of costs that are carried within the soft costs. Let me talk a little bit about the performance equipment, the theatrical equipment. On the left-hand side of this slide are the fixed, permanent, built into the building components of the performance infrastructure. On the right-hand side, again, the plug-and-play loose equipment that could be bought over time, it could be bought in the future, it could be deferred from the initial work. There's a variety of ways that the loose equipment can happen. Nonetheless, we've made some recommendations for what could be utilized. Within the built-in infrastructure for the fixed equipment, we have performance lighting systems of about $300,000 in allowance for the power and circuit distribution. For the house work and run lighting controls, for the network and equipment, all of the theatrical lighting controls these days are Wi-Fi enabled and have their own network that they run over. This provides that type of equipment to enable the systems. Emergency lighting transfer switch, the emergency lighting systems would also be tied into the theatrical lighting, so the two are speaking to each other. And other devices, performance lighting company switches, feeders, panel boards, all of the fixed built-in equipment that support the lighting systems are included within this $300,000 allowance. The stage rigging. So again, the different types of stage environments that I spoke about a moment ago would be equipped with chain motors, again, about a quantity of 16 to allow the grid to raise and lower. Light duty trusses about 200 feet in length. Rigging accessories to allow all of those pieces to function. And an array of base building stage drapes that could be augmented with traveling shows and other types of drapery and stage drops if they were to travel with such devices. But a house curtain, a black masking set of curtains to mask off the stage wings from audience view, a rear what's called cyclorama that could be lit for effect at the rear of the stage, scrims, the storage equipment for these drapes, and an installation allowance all within the rigging number for the performance equipment of about $338,000. The seating itself, the audience seating, fixed seats. We are not planning for loose seats within the overall arrangement of the orchestra and balcony areas. Allowance about 358,000 for the audience seating. And the sound and video systems of about $425,000. This is the main built-in loudspeaker system, main array at the what would be at the proscenium, the subwoofers, the fill speakers that would be arrayed throughout the audience to prevent delay, to make sure that those that are seated the furthest forward in the chamber are hearing the same thing that those are hearing at the rear of the chamber. Digital mixing consoles, assisted listening system is code required within the building for those of hard hearing to be tied into and have the same listening experience as the rest of the audience. Back of house paging and intercom to connect the dressing room areas, production areas to the stage manager and the action that's happening on stage. Motorized projection screen is accommodated with projector and installation. One of the secondary uses that was indicated through the market study could be film if it's curated and so forth. There is the possibility to do that on the stage with these systems. So the fixed built into the building performance and infrastructure totals about 1.4 million for all of those systems. And again, these are already carried within the numbers I described in the preceding slides. The loose equipment, and again, there's a lot of flexibility with how loose equipment can be purchased either day one, deferred into the future. Some of this can be rented, not purchased. There's a variety of things that can happen. The study makes a recommendation for an overall list of the types of equipment that can be accommodated. It assumes that it's bought day one as part of this package, but again, there's some flexibility in how ultimately the venue treats that into the future. Within the performance lighting arena of things and the performance lighting fixtures, there's a variety of different types of spotlights, of wash lights, of things that would light the rear of the stage. Two follow spots that would be portable, movable, and set up in the audience, and cable assemblies that allow the connectivity of all of the lighting. The demountable platforms that I spoke about a moment ago. A total of about maybe 8 units that would allow the stage to extend into the audience. It would mean there may be some of the first one or two rows of seats in the audience that could be removable, unbolted, removed, stored elsewhere to allow the stage to expand into the audience for different types of uses, different use scenarios. And all of the loose microphones, cables, to accommodate some of the sound, about $75,000 for that equipment. All of the loose equipment totaling about $352,000 within the allowance for loose items. I'll come back to the overall cost matrix again. Phase one, which is this initial column at the left, totaling about $30.1 million for day one opening of the venue. About 23 of that is associated with the hard costs to construct, and about 6.5, just over 6.5, associated with the loose and soft costs that I referred to a moment ago. As we come into the subsequent phases, those numbers are more modest in comparison. The below stage dressing room areas, again, about 1.4 million for the hard construction build out of those areas, about 600,000 or so affiliated with the soft costs for dressing room furnishing, fit out, and other types of soft costs. The street level, meaning the public lobby areas, the public restrooms at those areas, the production and dressing room support areas at street level, about 2.3 million in the hard construction build out for those zones of the building, about 1.2 associated with the loose soft costs furnishings to fit out those spaces. The exterior work for the exterior equipment pads, the loading dock, the new sloped loading drive from Olivia Street back to the loading dock, about $850,000 for the hard construction build out, about 300 or just over for the soft costs for that component of the renovation. And coming to the final column, which is the total all-in number, 28.1 million for the construction build out, all of the hard costs associated with the renovation, both the trade sub costs and all of the contingencies escalation that I mentioned a moment ago. And proportionally, a smaller amount for the soft costs, but one of about 9 million or just shy of 9 million for the soft costs for furnishings, for the professional fees, for the abatement for permitting and other costs, bringing the total cost for all phases, both hard and soft, escalated again to 2 years from now, first quarter of 2028 dollars, 36.9 million all in. I'll conclude with a few images that we wanted to pull up on the screen, some conceptual rendering diagrams that we wanted to share that show the existing room on the left-hand side and a concept for the completed renovated room on the right-hand side. You can see the audience build out and seating area on the orchestra, balcony one and balcony two, with perhaps a comedian taking the stage. From this vantage point, seated roughly within the side box of balcony one. And again, you can see the curvature of the existing horseshoe-shaped balcony. It is a fantastic place to be, and one of the defining characteristics of the room that must be maintained. In an image more from the rear of the first balcony, illustrating perhaps an ensemble taking the stage, a small band taking the stage for live music. And again, the existing room on the left-hand side, a conceptual rendering on the right. With that concludes the slides and information that I have to present to the group today. And if there are Gino, questions that the commission has, happy to speak about them further.
Evan, thank you. I appreciate the presentation. I want to, before we go further and open it up for questions from the committee, I want to have the commission vote on accepting the Steinberg Hart findings and recommendations. Can I have that in the form of a motion?
So moved.
Dana, second?
Second.
Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
Okay, so I just wanted to get that out of the way. First of all, Evan, thank you very much. I appreciate it. I just wanted to go over a few things, and just some of my comments on it. No, number one, the study that we just heard the presentation on from Steinberg Hart is an all-in cost budget that we worked really, really hard on. So I know, the comments maybe from the public or for people that just see a number written on a piece of paper, might be a little bit shocking. But what the other study from back in the early 2000s did was just give us a number on the subcontractor cost to do the work in simple terms. And if we broke that number down out of what we have here, it's about 12 million. So the other one was if we added for inflation. So just that number pretty much makes the mark of what the original study did. The second thing that I wanted to talk about is that, well, highlight actually is the options that we had in the study here. And the reason why we left the options open was for and so that we could attract an operator or a partner to come on board with us when the time is right. And this also led into the seating options so that we just didn't have either fixed cost, fixed design on this is what you have, take it or leave it, so that our options were just geared for one type of partner. So that's why we left the capacity, the seating design open, which I thought was a great idea. Also, too, the construction phasing is another highlight that people should take a look at. And then, the hard cost and the breakdown, especially with the phasing, the number is an all-in number. So it's been discussed that it's probably going to take 2 years for this study. And if a partner comes on board to actually get this idea onto contract documents and actually get it into a set of plans where a contractor could actually come out and do it. So that's why we extended this out to 2028 so that we know with the contingencies that are in there, the hard and the soft cost, where we should be by that time. So that's why it was spread out that far. And then also too, we geared this the study and the market analysis around the federal funding and the tax credits, especially to meet the requirements for the Department of Interior, because that's going to be very beneficial to us coming the next year or so. And then last but not least, oh, here we go. So the last comment that I have is this study cost us 100 grand. The work that was done and the detail that was put into it, in my opinion, it was a lot more than that. So I want to thank Steinberg Hart, the team at Stages, and especially the engineers that came time after time and time again to come into the Opera House, ask questions. Really get down to the detail by removing stuff so that we could actually get an exact size of some of the beams in the steel that were in the existing in the building so that there was really no guessing. And then also too, we have in the audience our state representative from the 114th, Mary Wielander. She played a huge part in getting us the money for this study. And without her hard work and determination, this study would never have been possible. So I want to say thank you to you and everybody that worked on your team to getting this done. Those are all the comments and pretty much the highlights of what I took out of that. Does anybody else from the commission have any comments or questions? No. Okay. So just to sum things up before we close. Once we get all the documents together, I'm going to call Amy at the subcommittee that deals with the Sterling Opera House Commission, and we are going to present the findings to her, hopefully get on the agenda, and then they could determine if it will go straight to the full board or if it will go to the subcommittee first, but we'll get with her. So that's going to be our next step. And I think that's pretty much it. That's all I have. You guys good? All right. So thank you. I want to thank everybody for coming. And we'll, excuse me.
Done.
Why were we invited?
To go through the findings of the
Watch the presentation.
You want to ask questions? Well, we could do that if you really want to. I mean, everybody came to the last meeting, gave your comments. We took those comments. Well, that's how we got to the final report. So what we could do is if you want to do that, I'll have to make a motion to open up the public comment then. You know, public portion and go backwards.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Mark Garfalo, town clerk, perhaps because allegedly everybody saw this for the first time tonight.
Yeah.
Perhaps it would be better to distribute it, make it available to the public so people can absorb it and read it. And at your next meeting, take comments so that people can absorb what has to go on. That's up to you.
Okay.
Because if you open up, you got to open up for everybody.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. So that's why I was going to open up the public portion.
Gino, I'll make the motion. Open it up to the public.
Okay. Do I have a second?
Second.
Dana? All right. So we're going to open up number five. We'll go back and we'll open up the public portion right now for some comments. Go ahead, Dave.
First of all, I think you did a spectacular job. Having done five theaters, raised the money for it, this is probably the best study I've ever seen. Most comprehensive, very to the point. A couple of points that I think need to be made. I love all what you had to say about the tax credits and the federal money. Given what's going on in Washington right now and what we're experiencing, we have no idea what's going to be available, if any. State money, Mary's sitting here, we can talk about that. There's a national organization for the restoration of historic theaters. We can approach them. They give grants in the neighborhood of 5 to 15 million. That would be a huge start. You project it out through 2028. This is a 36-month campaign before you raise the money, not 24 months. And when we do raise the money, all we're going to need is, because we'll have signed intent to give forms that are approved by the IRS, we're going to need to have 75% of the pledges pledged. We don't have to have the money in hand because we can use those for construction financing to get the shovel in the ground. But I think we're looking at least 3 years, okay? I love the way you broke it out. I can tell you that I already started working on a business plan for the building. Because I think it was incumbent upon me to do that, being as how we're going to have to come up with the fundraising plan. And you have the street level being dedicated to theater-related space. I have the street level being related to revenue production space, potentially a restaurant and the Aldermanic Chambers. I know of two Valley agencies that want to rent the lower floor space for their offices. So we've got to look to build in revenue centers, which you have with the concessions. But I think when we look at this overall project, we're looking at 36 months, if we're lucky. I think we got to be guarded on what we can expect from the feds. And then keep in mind that everything we do, because we're going to be looking for government money, has to go out to competitive bidding. So we don't know that those bids are going to come in here, lower, higher, more likely higher. And I can tell you from experience, the project I'm trying to complete in New York right now, 3 years ago, we projected it was going to cost us $24 million. We're at $40 million because of the cost of steel. And this is going to require a lot of steel and a lot of particular specialized building material. So I want to congratulate you on a great study. I think you've given us what we needed. But I think we have to go into this with our eyes open. And it's just not a matter of saying, well, it's $38 million. Let's go do it. You know, there's a great a movie that Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland were in, where they're sitting in a barnyard and some kid jumps up and says, "Hey, Gideon, let's put on a show." And 10 minutes later, the barn door is open and there's a set with Busley Berkeley coming down 75 states, steps with costumes and orchestras and everything else. That's not this. This is going to be a lot of hard work. So again, I want to thank you for what you did, but I want to put a little reality into what we're talking about. Thank you for.
You're welcome. Any other comments? Okay. So we'll move back to number eight. And we will, let's see, 7:42. Do I have a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Do I have a second? All in favor?
Bye.
All right. Thank you guys very much. I appreciate it.